I'm a familiar voice to you because what I am is a professional podcaster.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
You probably weren't expecting this show, but I've decided to put it on the feed because it plays into some of the themes that, if you listen to me on whether it's Dum De Dum or Mid-Atlantic or even How Jamaica Conquered the World, I talk about a lot. It's my love of being English, but also my Jamaican heritage and how that is important in viewing a sense of identity. David and I recorded this show some months ago, way before the Windrush scandal made its way into the popular consciousness of the average Brit. So it's timely that this week we spoke about Scar in a very light-hearted and fun way, an incredibly important marker in the way that England saw itself in the late 70s and 80s. It's not an overly academic conversation, as I said before, it is fun, but I think it's important. And I think also that not only is it timely, as I said before, but also if you like the show, why don't go on to a podcatcher of your choice and go and subscribe to The Things That Made England, because I can see this show becoming a real passion and love of mine. Because yes, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool lefty, but in no way, shape or form am I some kind of nationalist that believes that everything that comes out of England is superior to anywhere else. People of all skin colours, all political hues, we should be able to celebrate the culture of the country that we're born into. And this is what this series means to me. So take a listen. And if you enjoy it, why don't you subscribe to The Things That Made England?
It was the best of time. It was the worst.
She was the people's princess.
We shall fight on the beaches.
Oh, wait, man. These are the things that made England.
We shall fight on the landing ground.
These are the things that made England.
I have the body but of a weak and feeble woman.
These are the things that made England.
And a king of England, too.
These are the things that made England.
Cry God for Harry!
And these are the things that made England.
England! And St. George!
These are the things that made England.
Hello and welcome to the second episode of The Things That Made England. I'm Roy Phil Brown, and with me I have...
David Crowther of The History of England.
Right, what do you mean? Mr. Crowther.
What do you mean?
Well, I think, right, that you started off quite well on our first episode with 1066. A bit obvious, but it needed to go in the old cabinet, didn't it? Because 1066 is important.
Yeah.
But there's aspects of modern British culture which I think get overlooked. So I'm proposing that this week we do Scar.
Sorry, can you spell that?
Scar, S-K-A. But Scar, not hey. That bloke from The Lion King.
Okay, not that one. Okay,
not him. That kind of first signal of multicultural England in popular culture. You know, it gives skinheads a certain way of dressing for mods. White working class men loved to dance to it and still do. And it was metropolitan, David. It was awesome. It came from Coventry, it came from Birmingham, it came from London. you know, via Jamaica. And the two-tone movement promoted racial unity at a time when racial tensions were high in the UK in the late 70s. You know, all those riots and stuff. And it was all about people getting together. So I think that Scar needs to go in because it's not just about music. What do you reckon?
So you're seriously, you're coming here.
Yes.
Last time we talked about
yes.
1066, and you're telling me that a musical style I can't even spell and think is a bloke from the Lion King should go into the cabinet alongside William the Conqueror. That's what you're saying to me. You know, just to make sure I'm clear.
Well, I think we're kind of going to get to the heart of how we view England doing this series, aren't we? There is the stuff from the Lady Bird history books.
Uh-huh.
You know, old kings and old dusty writers of great literature and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Boring stuff, and, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we know it's important and it's drilled into us at school. And then there are the things, the visceral things that make England, modern England, different from, let's say, France, make it different from America, which are quintessentially English, but you have to be English to know about it. You haven't read about it in books. And I think maybe that's where I'm going to come at this with this series. So, what is Scar? Now, I think we need to take a step back, and really there's a whole wider reason why Scar is so important, because racial diversity is one of the facets that separates England from the rest of the parts of the United Kingdom. Now, while the UK's white population totals just over 55 million, or 87%, and that's according to the 2011 census, just under 13% or over 7.5 million are non-white. Now, the reason why that's particularly important is that over 90% of all British ethnic minorities actually live in England. So you can forget Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland for this. Majority of them live in England. And I've found in its major cities, whether it's Birmingham, my hometown, London, Leicester, Luton, Manchester, Wolverhampton, you know the drill.
Yeah,
and it's the arrival of the first mass wave of non-white immigrants in 1948 on the Empire Windrush that really started, I would say, modern England. Before that, you got George Formby, George Formby films, you've got Queen Victoria, you've got all that kind of stuff. Then all of a sudden, after the Second World War, we have black and brown Britons. And I think that's really where modern England started. It's a country which is comfortable enough to say that its favourite food is curry, right, and where Jafakan can displace Cockney as the dialect of the capital's kids. So mm-hmm. this episode is broadly about that, really, viewed through the prism of one aspect of English culture, Scar.
Okay.
With me so far?
I'm with you. I am with you. I feel like I take the point. I'm amazed about your figures, actually, I must admit. So I'm busy looking up the racial makeup of Wales, for example.
The racial makeup of the UK in terms of the ethnic diversity really can be boiled down to a few major cities. So Birmingham could be majority minority now. We don't know. By the time of the 2021 census, we will know. But basically, that means that white folks are in the minority. Ditto Leicester. So Birmingham and Leicester are vying for the accolade of being the first major UK cities where white indigenous people are in the minority. When you actually realise it, that the majority of non-white people in the UK live in Birmingham, London. I think in London, something like 30%. Right. Leicester, Luton, like places like Bradford, and then Leeds. When you strip those out, England is actually extremely, extremely white. So it's metropolitan. And that goes to the heart of the reason why Scar is so important. So Scar is this music genre that originated in Jamaica in the late 1950s. It combines elements of Caribbean mento and rhythm and blues. And it's a Jamaican take on rhythm and blues, really.
I'm going to have to start with that at that moment, Roy Field. Mm-hmm. Caribbean mento?
Well, it's if you think of like Harry Belafonte, O Island in the Sun, very singy-songy, somewhat light, very musical, that's right. Kind of mento. So Island in the Sun is a perfect example of that. By the end of the late 1950s, with the advent of rock and roll, people in Jamaica start to have their own take on it. At first, they did exact copies of those songs, but then they accented the offbeat. So they're skank, 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 which is exactly where the term ska comes from. It's the offbeat of the guitar. So ska then comes over to England in the early 1960s with records by people like Prince Buster or Clement Cogston Dodd. And it comes over to England on the backs of Jamaican immigrants. And these move to the big cities of the UK, as we said, Birmingham, London, and let's say Leicester. Now, Scarf scores its first big hit in 1964 with Millie Spall's My Boy Lollipop. To the average person, this is just a song, a cute song, sang by, I think she was a teenager at the time. She's very young, Millie Small, and it's kind of bubblegum pop, but it's a ska record. And if you are, or if you were, a newly arrived Jamaican or West Indian immigrant, that song was absolutely groundbreaking because it said that our culture, their culture, was also valid and it was part of wider English culture. But what Scar then goes on to do, now, first off, that record actually sells a boatload of records, David. 600,000 is what it sells in the United Kingdom. Gets to number 2 in the US Billboard Hot 100.
Right.
But what those Jamaican immigrants actually did was they set a certain style for white working class kids. So they wore Dr. Martin boots, tight trousers, Crombies, and that became aped by white working class kids in those cities, and they became skinheads, all these Jamaican immigrants, because they couldn't afford to dress really well. So they had this really cheap but stylish way of dressing, which white working class kids then started to ape. Then they started to listen to their music. So you had, by the late 70s, the first wave of British skinheads, which are not the skinheads that we know now, popular culture. Right. They were absolutely into reggae, ska, and Jamaican culture.
Right.
And it's kind of one of these kind of weird kind of perversions that actually now we see skinheads as being incredibly racist, where actually they embraced West Indian culture. Anyway.
That is a weird change. Yes, no, I mean, I wouldn't have remembered them in that way.
Many people don't, but it's really really interesting. When you look back at the old documentaries, there's always these white skinheads with black skinheads. They dressed the same. You look at in the 60s, they dressed the same and they were all listening to Jamaican music.
That all went wrong in the 70s is what we're saying.
It all went wrong in the late 70s. But one thing that did go right in the late 70s was two-tone. And that's the second wave of ska. So you have this first wave of ska, which is all Jamaican music.
Right.
By the late 70s, you've got kind of the energy of punk fused with ska again. So by the late 70s, you've got the Specials, you've got Madness, you've got Bad Manners doing this stuff. And these groups are, if they're not multiracial, they're white, white singers. So Madness was an all-white group. Bad Manners was multiracial. The Selector would have been multiracial. This stuff is faster. A lot of it is copies of Jamaican ska from the 60s, but done with a very British sensibility. It was a total phenomenon for about 3 years. You had white working class kids pogoing around. It's incredibly easy to dance to. It just sounds like an instant party as soon as you put it on the turntable. And all the West Indians, people like my father, were incredibly proud. And they said, we truly have arrived because those white folks have got their own take on our music. And for me, the story and the importance of ska is that because it does what the English do best, whether it's tea or fried fish in batter. Two things which are taken from other cultures, tea from India, fried fish in batter was Jewish, but they make it their own. And that's what they do with ska.
That's a very positive way of putting it. So we nick other people's cultures, essentially, is what you're saying.
Well, the posh way say we appropriate, but yes, whatever.
we do it with cricket players as well. Two-tone is the only thing I remember, essentially. My boy Lollipop, of course I remember, everybody knows that. But two-tone, I think, is the only thing I've recognised when we started talking about this.
You know the Vitalite advert, get up in the morning, same thing for breakfast. That's ska, but it's slower.
Right.
And the history of Jamaican ska is that ska comes first, and then it slows down and becomes a thing called rocksteady, which I absolutely adore rocksteady.
What is rocksteady?
Rocksteady is this not-so-accented Jamaican music. So Dawn Penn's No, No, No is a classic rocksteady song. And it's this period of Jamaican music from about 1965 to 68. It's very, very short. But the ska slows down. And it's before you get to real reggae. So around about 68, 69, then reggae hits, which is slower again on the accent on bass. Because you think about ska for a Jamaican music, it's not bass accented. It's completely on the offbeat with the rhythm. And the connection between ska and reggae is the on the offbeat. But the ska is but reggae is It just slows down. So as you were, David, what were you saying?
Very good. Okay, so
you agree with me? It's in the cabinet. Show done.
Far be it from me to let something go in the cabinet that easily, Royfield. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You know, I'm not saying I'm against the idea, but I just had a few thoughts. Actually, I chatted about my wife actually, and I said to her, "Are we going to have this conversation?" And he said, "Really?" And so what's that all about? And I said, "Well, you know, that's the thing I remember about ska." I remember three things about ska. I remember the Specials.
Yeah,
I remember Madness and Suggsy, and I remember finally having found a music that I could dance to, because there was a format of raising your left leg and your right arm at the same time, turning your head one way, and then raising your left arm and your right leg and turning your head the other way away from your arm. And I could do that for the first time, Royfield, I could dance.
It's one of the reasons why I say it needs to go into the cabinet, because
I will give you that much, that as you say, for the first time I could dance. But Jane said to me, she said, well, actually, but you never saw women do that. Was a boy thing, wasn't it? You know, you all got together, you went in a corner and you did the dance thing, and the girls went and did something else, something interesting. I have to say, she's got a point, hasn't she? No. So all the time I thought I could dance, Royfield, well, I could dance, but I couldn't dance with anything else, could I?
There's
just
almost
me.
A song title in that you can dance with if you have to. But anyway, she's making a really good point.
It has to be said. It always does.
When you remember ska, at least two-tone ska, It's a white and black working class movement. That's the way that you remember it. And though there was Selector with Pauline Black as the lead singer, all of those bands were pretty male. I will give you that. The Specials were all male, Madness were all male.
Yes, they were.
They were. However, it's the cultural and social importance of ska, which is wider than, let's say, any perceived, I would say, issues to do with exclusion of women. What you had by the late 1970s is some 20 years of mass non-white immigration into the UK. And attitudes in the media were changing, but only very slowly. Early 70s, you had Enoch Powell, Rivers of Blood speech, saying that that the country's going to go to hell in a handbasket. You've got things like Love Thy Neighbour.
Oh, my God, you remember that?
Yes, I do. Which my father actually loved Love Thy Neighbour. But looking at it now, crude racial stereotypes.
Oh, frightening, isn't it? I mean, we're talking about something else really now, aren't we? But that is, you know, everybody needs to watch that movie to see how that TV program, see how things have changed. Because, yes, at the time we thought it was all fine, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Ordinary. Yeah.
So all the popular depictions of non-white Britons of that time were negative and were stereotyped. And ska gave us something new. It actually told us what England was like on the ground, that actually these communities were learning to live together, to learn from each other, and were dancing together. That's the reason why ska is really important. It's the first time that English culture is seen as not being wholly white, but it's still inclusive.
Okay, so I've got my three objections, as it were. So number one is, I take that point, well made. Number one is, it's really a boy thing. Nothing necessarily wrong with that, but, you know, it's a boy thing. Second thing, I've got a quote for you. I actually went on the line and I found a quote. Okay, are you ready for this?
Okay.
Okay. I don't know who this quote from, actually. Maybe it's my grandmother. I kind of doubt it, I have to say. But anyway, it took all the anger out of music and replaced it with a silly pseudo-reggae stew. So the argument is that basically, you know, here we've got reggae, which is, you know, has a real edge to it. And here, you know, we've got this nice, melodic, twangy type of music, which, you know, is all about, you know, well, my boy Lollipop, baggy trousers. The Specials, I always felt, were slightly different. They had a bit more of an edge to them, it always seemed to me. Mm. But the accusation, I suppose, is that it took all that energy and it kind of turned it into a, you know, just a bit of fun.
What's wrong with fun? It's the end of the 1970s. England has lost its place in the world as, you know, we don't have an empire anymore. There's no British Empire anymore. We've had a three-day week in the early 1970s. Our economy has shrunk compared to every other major economy in Europe. What was wrong with us having a little bit of fun before we entered the dark years of Thatcher?
Right. Okay, well, there's a future episode for you. Okay, so you're saying it doesn't matter. You know, there needed to be a bit of a fun side.
I think there's a lot of inverted snobbery in that statement.
I think
to say that any kind of creative art form has got to be about deep, dark, meaningful things. Anything which is sunny and upbeat and fun is not of the same intellectual heft. I just think it's just snobbery.
Okay, I'm going to give you one more. Okay, it was a very local thing, wasn't it? Well, that's the impression I was got, that ska was, you know, it wasn't a US thing, it wasn't a global thing, it wasn't like the Beatles or whatever. This was,
well, you're kind of wrong, right?
Okay. Kind of.
If you go and Wikipedia ska, there's three waves of ska, right? So there is, it comes out of Jamaica in the 60s. By the late 60s, ska is done. It disappears. It then reappears in England, in Coventry, Birmingham, in London, three English cities that have large West Indian, large Jamaican populations, immigrant populations. So that's where the music gets reinterpreted by white working class youth, with young black working class youth rediscovering their father's records. That's how it all comes about in the late 70s. Right. The third wave of ska actually goes all around the world. So there's a third wave of ska movement in the US. There's loads of ska bands, and they're almost analogous to kind of punk bands, kind of in a way, in the US. So there's like West Coast ska. There is there are ska bands in Germany. The third wave of ska is faster still than how we remember it in Two Tone, and kind of can be incredibly raucous, a bit kind of punky, but there are different takes on it. So actually, ska has gone all around the world. And the third wave of ska bands, which are not actually in the UK, actually do look back at that two-tone 70s era of being the progenitor of the third wave of ska. So if you don't believe me, sorry, wiki it. It's all there.
I would, of course, absolutely believe you. I think those are my objections, really. Are those the only questions?
Which I've swatted away easily.
Well, the only thing I end up with in summary is say, well, look, you know, it's great. Okay, I get the point about the cultural impact of it. I think the only question I'm saying is it really, you know, is it such a big thing? Does it deserve to go into the cabinet? You know, it's not a boy thing, not a girl thing. It's
about more important than that, David. It's about modern England becoming comfortable with the new reality on the ground.
Right.
And I've used ska, and I said in my preamble that I'm using ska really as a pointer of a new modern England. Instead of me saying racial harmony, let's put that, relative racial harmony, let's put that in the cabinet. You can't do that. But I've used ska. I've used this one kind of totem,
right,
of culture, appropriation, mixing, heritage, whatever the word you want to say, to show that the England of the late 1970s was very different from the England, let's say, late 1950s, in how it saw itself through its popular musical culture.
Okay, so I had to say that coming from Leicester being my hometown, the late 1970s in Leicester saw the emergence of Shawaddy Waddy. So it's about time that I have to leaven my criticism of or any denigration of Coventry and Birmingham in the light of that statement, do I not?
Well, listen, I'll let you into a secret, David. The first band I ever saw live was Shawaddy Waddy.
Don't say it, Rifle. Don't say it. They can actually live down the road from me, funnily enough. Anyway, that's another story. So, great. One last question. Tell me about Buster Blood Vessel.
To be honest with you, I don't know an awful lot about him other than he was overweight, had a bald head, used to stick his tongue out a lot. You know, he always looked like he's about to have a heart attack.
Indeed, he's always said he's had too much fish and chips. All right, so look, the trouble we're going to have with this program all the way through is that I'm an absolute pushover, incapable of saying no. So I find I am convinced by your arguments. Scar should go in the cabinet, if nothing else, for no other reason than anything that comes from the Midland ought to have a free card into the cabinet. That is not the right reason.
That means that Shakespeare's going to squeeze in then, is he?
Uncontested. Well, I suppose he's a Midland lad, isn't he? Good point.
Yeah.
But of course, it's not us that decide in the end, Roy Field. We're going to put it up on Facebook, and we're going to let the people vote. Because as we know from Brexit, did I really mention Brexit? It's the people that decide.
This is Fiona with a roundup of our Facebook page for this fortnight. I like erring on the side of caution, so I'm going to mention folk by first name only, and where necessary, last name initial. I do this to preserve a modicum of anonymity for you, in case you nominate your great aunt Gladys's rock cakes as the monster that broke England's back, or if you happen to be on the wrong side of the great pizza debate. If you'd rather your full name or title used, do let Luke or I know, and we'll proceed accordingly. It's been a very busy fortnight, with an impressive number of you leaping in to add your ideas. We began with the poll. 1066, do we add it to the cabinet? An overwhelming yes. One undecided must have been the person with the Saxon mother and Norman father, and one lone no. At the end of the poll, David asked for some suggestions for future episodes, and the deluge arrived. Bill nominated the Spitfire and Liz Hurley. which gave me a moment's pause until I realised that he was describing a classic English beauty. I couldn't agree more, Bill. The Spitfire is the classic English beauty. Kathy said, I'm surprised nobody has mentioned The Shed. Steve's proposal of J.B. Priestley led to a very interesting read. Claire suggested the BBC and garden centres. I'm with you on garden centres, Claire. It's always the first activity on the list when I visit my daughter in Yorkshire. At the last count, there were 28 items on the list, but that won't keep David and Royfield busy enough, so I hope you'll add more. David began a rant on food by praising the worthy Bakewell tart and honouring the lardy cake. Catherine said, I draw the line at steak and kidney pudding and any type of English pea, mushy, canned, etc. And Rowena defended the mushy pea nobly with a how very dare you. And then the pizza debate began. I think it was Daniel who started it, and it didn't take long before it became a bun fight over suitable crusts, until at last Andrew gave us a pause by declaring, liver and onions, food of the gods, followed swiftly by Steve V countering, of the underworld. Then Bianca, who I think must be an ex-prefect, came into the fray, offering reason. I'm sure I wasn't the only one who appreciated her touch. The thread, as Andy said, is a long one, but an excellent read. Just after Bill reminded us of Henry's speech at Agincourt, as penned by Will Shakespeare, Royfield posted a fascinating map of the British Isles showing the United Kingdom by preferred source for chip shop chips. Try saying that three times fast. It's a very important map, and we'd really like to hear your preferences, and especially how they correspond with the part of England that you most associate with. So please go onto the Facebook page and make your voices heard. Cheers until next time, and cry God for Harry, England, and I'll have gravy on my chips.
Right, all right. Great. Thank you, Royfield. Great, very good.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, sir. And what are we going to do next week?
Next week, why don't we do accents?
Ooh, all right, then.
Do that. I think this time I will pitch to you that the one of the things that makes England is the glory of the diversity of our accents.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.